I prepared a lesson out of Proverbs 7 because I was trying to move along a little faster just so that we can cover some ground. And then I started looking back over what I was skipping, and I may go in reverse here the next time we get together. But for tonight, let's look at Proverbs 7. And our first step is to read this chapter together, and we'll try to cover it. It's pretty much a capsulization. It's pretty much a contained little segment of the book of Proverbs. Very interesting text. Proverbs 7, starting in verse 1. My son, keep my words and lay up my commandments with thee. Keep my commandments and live, and my law as the apple of thine eye. Bind them upon thy fingers, write them upon the table of thine heart. Say unto wisdom, thou art my sister, and call understanding thy kinswoman, that they may keep thee from the strange woman, from the stranger who flattereth with her words. For at the window of my house I looked through my casement and beheld among the simple ones, I discerned among the youths a young man void of understanding, passing through the street near her corner, and he went the way to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And behold, there met him a woman with the attire of a harlot and subtle of heart. She is loud and stubborn, her feet abide not in her house. She is now without, now in the streets, and lieth in wait at every corner. So she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him, I have peace offerings with me, this day have I paid my vows. Therefore came I forth to meet thee diligently to seek thy face, and I have found thee. I have decked my bed with coverings of tapestry, with embroidered works, with fine linen of Egypt. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, alloys, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love until the morning. Let us solace ourselves with love. For the goodman is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He hath taken a bag of money with him, and will not come home, and will come home at the day appointed. With her much fair speech, she caused him to yield. With the flattering of her lips, she forced him. He goeth after her straightway, as an ox goeth to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till a dart strike through his liver, as a bird hasteneth to the snare, and knoweth not that it is for his life. Hearken unto me now, therefore, O ye children, and attend to the words of my mouth. Let not thine heart decline to her ways, go not astray in her paths, for she hath cast down many wounded, yea, many strong men have been slain by her. Her house is the way to hell, going down to the chambers of death. Well, a most interesting section of Proverbs. Again, we have seen this section starting in chapter 1 and running all the way through chapter 9 is this long parable, or I call it a parable of wisdom. It is a parable to extol the thing we call wisdom. Now, what have we learned about wisdom? What are some things that have stuck with you? Has anything stuck with you? It's gained over time. In other words, we make the mistake. Interesting, I had a conversation just earlier this week, a man saying, I just need answers. I need answers. The Lord said, ask wisdom and he'll give it. And I asked and I've tried to explain to him what I've explained to y'all is that that passage in James 1 where God offers wisdom to people is not giving you the right answer. It's offering to train you with the discipline needed for you to arrive at the right answer. That's wisdom. Wisdom is the background. It's the training. It's the discipline of understanding that's based on a worldview that is based on the fear of God. It's looking through a particular grid. It's taking into account the whole picture. in order to arrive at right answers. And we just want to take the shortcut. We love instant. I love instant everything. Wasn't for instant everything, I'd starve to death these days. I got instant everything. You know, I'm a, what is it old Joan Rivers used to say? She stood in front of the microwave yelling, hurry. You know, we're that impatient. Well, that's the way we are. We want things and we want it now and we want wisdom now. Well, it just doesn't work that way. I've given you some illustrations about some things you just can't get instantly. What are they? Maybe you've thought of a few more. An athlete. You want to play a sport. Barbie, of course, got a swim team, teaches swimming. You can't become a competitive swimmer in one day. This doesn't work. What else? A musician. You want to learn to play an instrument. You say, I want to be a concert pianist. Do you have a course that you can teach me that in a day? No. Uh-uh. Doesn't work that way. I told you about my buddy, the best pianist I ever knew, that all the people would come to him saying, I just want you to teach me how to play piano like you do, but I don't want to learn scales and arpeggios and all of that. And he said, you don't understand. That's how I play the way I do. It's knowing all those scales and those arpeggios. That's what you've got to do. That's the training. Anything else? Foreign language, excellent example. It ought to be because I thought it up. What's wrong with you guys coming up with some ideas here? But a foreign language. I want to learn Spanish in a day. I'm sorry. Doesn't work. You can't get instant wisdom. Wisdom is a process of training and discipline by which we acquire the tools allowing us to make proper and good decisions. Anybody come up with any new, what'd you say? A scientist, yeah. I want to be a scientist or a carpenter, a husband or a father. That's a good point. We think we know it all till we get there, and then out the window that goes. And notice that the training that's going on here is from parents. It seems it is the mother that's speaking to a son earlier in Proverbs. Now it's clearly a father. As you can see tonight, the subject matter, sexual immorality, is clearly the talk that a father ought to have with his son, warning him about what's out there in the world. But notice again that in the ancient world, most of the training that went on didn't go on in the university, didn't go on in the school, it went on in the home. And especially a father with a son. The father trained the son to allow him to learn how to do what the father could do. And that's what's going on here. Well, all right, this is our sixth section we've looked at, and we may go backwards. I got to look it over some of the stuff I'm skipping, and I don't know. I don't know if I can skip this. In verses 1 through 5, notice again, we have another call for the importance of wisdom. Notice in verse 1, don't let my words leave you. Store them up like you would store up treasures, like you would store up wheat or food. Store up these words. How would you store up words? You've got to memorize. You've got to be able to recite. And again, memorization takes time. This takes repetition, going over and over something till it just becomes second nature. Notice in verse 2, don't look at my commandments in verse 2 as something to constrain you, something to chafe you, but look at them. He uses the expression here in verse 2, think of my law as, he calls it, the apple of thine eye. What is that expression? You've heard somebody's the apple of your eye? Anybody ever heard that before? Okay, all right. What does it mean? I've heard people talk about the anatomy of the eye and talk about the apple of the eye. I don't think that's what's going on here. When you say something's the apple of your eye, it's what? Has your attention. If I say so-and-so is the apple of my eye, what am I saying? Has my attention, that's for sure. It's your everything. It is your treasure. This is the thing that you highly, highly value. What the expression means to me. Maybe somebody, I've never heard anybody say you're the banana of my eye or something like that. But the apple of my eye, In other words, and notice this is how you are to view this training and this teaching. That's how valuable it is. Verse 3, keep it before you. And you'll notice both inward and outward. In verse 3, bind them upon your fingers and then write them on the table of your heart. The fingers, the outside, the heart, the inside. So apply these teachings to both the inward and the outward. How you feel, how you think, and how you act, and how you behave. Then verse 4, I like this one. Say unto wisdom, you're my sister. Call understanding thy kinswoman. What in the world does that mean? Why would you call wisdom your sister or your kinswoman? Okay, you wouldn't want to offend them, but let me ask you this. Can you generally trust the counsel of a sister most of the time? Well, maybe not. We're looking at Jeremy over here. He's outnumbered. But in other words, what we're talking about here is treat wisdom as if it is part of the family, a family that is looking out for you, that is seeking your good, your benefit, your welfare. You understand? In other words, think of wisdom as a sister who is helping you, who's looking out for you. Then notice in verse 5, now we're getting down to brass tacks. Verse 5 comes specifically to what the wisdom is going to help you do, and it's going to keep you from this strange woman. Now, when we think of strange women, I won't even go into that, and then some translate this a foreign woman, but most of the modern translations speak of it as a prostitute, as an adulterous woman. Anybody got an ESV or NIV? What you read, Chris? What's that? A forbidden woman. That gets right down to the topic now that's going to unfold in this next section. So this is sort of the preamble. I want to impress upon you the importance of wisdom, how it works, and we're going to specifically apply wisdom to this strange, forbidden woman. Yeah, please help. Well, I don't know. Maybe that'll help her go into labor. I don't know. Toting stuff here. All right, this next section deals with what I call the seduction of sin, the seductive power, the alluring, tempting power of sin. I remember somebody said, I can resist everything but temptation. That sort of sums it up. Yeah, I guess you could. But the problem is that temptation tempts you. It's seductive. And notice that this section, although it is couched in the language of a prostitute alluring a young man, I believe it has a whole lot more to say to us than just the area of sexual immorality. It certainly speaks to that area, no question about it. But what it's illustrating through this picture is the whole nature of the way sin works. In other words, it's just not sexual lust that works this way, but all sin tends to work this way. It could be drugs. It could be alcohol. It could be lying. It could be stealing. You could almost put anything in here, and it would be exactly the same thing. However, it's far more obvious when you're dealing with the area of sexual temptation. Okay? Let's remember, it speaks of the seductive power of sin. So how's this work? Well, let's look at the victim. The problem with this victim, he didn't have a clue he's in the sights. Most of the time, victims don't. Notice in verse 6 and 7, it begins by the father saying, I looked out my window. I looked out through the lattice. It's interesting that they would have lattice on their windows in the ancient times, in Solomon's day. But I looked out through the lattice and I saw this simple fella, this youth. Now, when he calls him a simple youth, what's he saying? Well, he's not smart, but he's not necessarily dumb. He's naive and inexperienced in particular. Here's a young fella who's inexperienced, and notice the last statement there, a young man void of understanding. In other words, the commodity that the father is trying to impress upon his son that you desperately need, this young fellow doesn't have it. Okay? And so the understanding that would prepare him for the situation he's about to face is completely missing in this young man's life. So he is just a sitting duck. He is going to be in the crosshairs here in a minute. Notice in verse 8, it begins in verse 8, with him passing through the street near her corner, he went the way to her house. Now, it does not tell us whether this is accidental. I'm tending to think he consciously steers himself near her house. In other words, he's heading through what we would call the red light district. Okay? He's headed into an area of danger, and therefore what he's doing is flirting with the temptation. That's how this all starts. And this next thing we notice in verse 9, is that this is happening under the cover of darkness. You know Paul talks about the works of darkness take place in the darkness, and he talks about immorality and drunkenness and so forth, that those things typically seek darkness where they occur. And notice the progression here in verse 9, from the twilight to the evening to the black and dark night. You're just going from darker and darker and darker. Now, why would sin tend to transpire under the cover of darkness? What is that saying to us? Nobody can see you. It's hidden. And then the idea of anonymity. Nobody knows who you are. And so those two features are coming into play here in that this is happening under this cover. Okay? So that's the victim. That's the fellow who's walking into danger, and he has no clue of that it's about to happen. He has no clue how to prepare himself for what lies ahead. He is no match for what he's about to meet. And here we see the woman described. First of all, in verse 10, let me just ask you this. You ever seen a prostitute? Pretty much everybody has. Now, I don't mean visit a prostitute. I mean see one on the street. You ever seen one? Sure. Why did you know it was a prostitute? You walk up and ask her? You say, hey, you're lady of the evening? You're pro? What? Is that what you said? How would you know she was a prostitute? You said you've seen one. The way she's dressed. And the way she acts. And that's exactly what is brought to our attention first here. It's how she's dressed. Number one, in verse 10, they're met him a woman with the attire of a harlot and subtlety, and that means deviousness, shrewdness of heart. In other words, she's looking for prey. She's on the prowl, so to speak. How does a prostitute dress? You said you know them by their dress, how they dress. It's how they don't dress. In other words, number one, they show a lot of skin, right? How else? The way they present themselves, their gaudy makeup, overdone, overblown, out front, in your face. Isn't it interesting that, yeah, you think about it. Yeah, I've seen prostitutes. Well, how'd you know? You didn't have to walk up and ask them. You could tell by the way they dressed and the way they acted. And that's exactly what's being described here. Verse 10 is her dress. Verse 11 is her way. Her nature, her character is loud, rebellious, and pushy is what I've put up here. She is calling out. My wife grew up in New Orleans, and they used to take their church groups down Bourbon Street to there's a place down there where the black bands played the old No Alcohol or anything. Can't remember the name of that place. Preservation Hall. And they would go down there after church on Sunday nights. That was just what you did in New Orleans when you're a teenager and so forth. And sometimes they would have, you know, dates. They'd go with the boys. And she'd get so mad because the women in the French Quarter were yelling at their dates. And she just thought they was playing with them. She didn't know till later what was really going on, that they were trying to entice them up to their place. And so notice the character is loud here. She's loud. She's rebellious. Stubborn is the word King James uses. In your face, out front, is the character. Again, the character of a prostitute. Verse 12, she's flitting. I use flitting because I couldn't think of a better word. You know what it means to flit? And what's the sound of music? The little song, she flits, she flits, you know. It's just that you're flighty. You flit, you flight. You pop here, you pop there. She's all over the place. Notice the expression here, verse 12, she's without. Now she's in the streets. She's lying in wait at every corner. Everywhere you look, there she is. And of course, what it's depicting is the prostitute's looking for prey. She's looking for a customer. And so she's not in her house. Notice in the last part of verse 11, she's out on the street. And she's here and she's there and she's everywhere. She's roaming, looking for her victim. And so that's the picture of the prey, the young man, devoid of wisdom, can't see what's coming, and his adversary is the woman. How do you think this is going to turn out? Not very good. And sure enough, now we see the ambush that takes place. Now, I want you to remember, we're talking about a prostitute enticing a customer, but we're really talking about a whole lot more than that. We're talking about the whole way that sin works in your life. Okay? So it's all of this is just describing the process using this very, very vivid and out front metaphor and parable. Okay, let's talk about how the ambush happens. Number one, in verse 13, you'll notice she comes, I say shamelessly, it uses the term impudent, with an impudent face. We don't use that word very much, but shameless is about as close as you can get. Somebody else have a translation better than that? What is it? Brazen, yeah, that's good. Brazen, no shame. In other words, she comes on to him. Bold, yeah. Without any hesitation, and shame is again the idea, shameless, because what would normally another woman would be, you wouldn't dare act this way. She has no problem acting this way. She comes up and kisses him. Notice in verse 13, she catches him and kisses him. And kissing, of course, was very common in the Hebrew world. However, generally men kissed men and women kissed women. Men would kiss their wives out of sight, but not out in public. And so this was a very brazen, shameless act. You remember the story of Isaac and Rebekah going down to Abimelech, and he pawns her off again, just like his father did, as his sister instead of his wife. And he looks out the window one day, and it says he saw Isaac sporting with his wife. And said, "Hey, what are you doing? You know, come in here. Let me have a talk with you, boy. What's going on?" So in other words, this would not be something that's done in public. So this is a very brazen act, an act of feigning affection. Notice in verse 14 and 15, she talks about, "Well, I've just paid my vows and I've got this peace offering," which is quite interesting, because remember, anybody here remember what the details of a peace offering was? I just went through this with the students in Mexico when we were down there. Should have had all of you in there, I guess. A peace offering, remember, you bring it to the temple tabernacle, and part of it is given to God on the altar, part of it is given to the priest, and then you take the rest of it and you eat it. And so she's saying, basically, "I've got dinner cooked. I've got extra meat. I've got a meal ready." And then this idea that "I was looking for you. Notice, I came forth to meet you. I diligently was seeking your face." Actually, she's seeking anybody's face, but she's coming on, "I was looking for you, and lo and behold, I found you." And it is the idea that, look, this is just destiny. It's just in the stars. We're supposed to meet. It is pretending that this is just all accidental, and that this is, boy, the idea of, well, this is just God's will for us to meet like this. I was looking. I was trying to find you. I've got the dinner cooked, and lo and behold, here you are. What a deal. And so now she gets around to business. My bed is luxurious and perfumed. She speaks of how opulent her bed is. The tapestries, the linens. Keep in mind, we take linens for granted, but in that time, linen came out of Egypt. Very, very expensive. So this is a decked out bed. And plus, on top of everything else, it is perfumed. In a day where everybody smelled, perfumes were very important. And so it is back to the idea of overdone, makeup overdone. Well, so it is. The bed is perfumed. In other words, she is describing a paradise awaiting you. A paradise of pleasure. And sure enough, in verse 18, basically, come, let us take our fill of love until the morning. Let us solace ourselves with love. Now, it's interesting, her definition of love is actually sex, right? But to him, let's go make love. And all night long. So everything's ready. Well, to top it all off, she's married. In verse 19 and 20, she says, well, don't have to worry about the goodman here is actually the husband. My husband's gone. He's on a business trip. He's got some money with him. He's not going to be back till the text should read the full moon. In other words, he's not coming home for a while. So we don't have anything to worry about. Notice what the way, do you begin to see the trap springing, set into motion? Everything is in place. This guy, the simple youth, doesn't stand a chance. And so let's look at the success of sin. Number one, in verse 21, he is absolutely no match for her wiles. Notice, I like the way this puts it here. She causes him to yield. With the flattering of her lips, she forces him. I mean, she's a woman, he's a man. What do you mean she's forcing him? But notice that the language is not talking about the force of strength, physical strength. It's talking about the force of her words. The allurement of what she's offering is just putting him in a position where he cannot resist. Literally. He is utterly defenseless against her tricks, her wiles. Interesting stuff. We go a little further. So, he's led away like an ox to the slaughter. Notice that you sort of get the feeling of how this thing's going to end, and it's not going to end well. He is being led away like an ox to a slaughter, or I realize the King James says to a fool to the correction of the stocks. I don't know if it's a textual difference or a translation difference, but most of the other versions says version said like a deer to the noose or the trap. Anybody have a what is your like a deer to the noose. Yeah, it's like a trap is laid there in the ground. So he is just walking along, walking right into this ambush, or like a bird to a snare. And of course, snares and traps work because you don't see them. If you could see them, they wouldn't work. But it's the fact that you don't see it coming. That's what makes them so deadly. And notice he's being led away, and verse 23, this is deadly stuff, till a dart or an arrow pierces his liver. That doesn't sound very pleasant, and what he's describing here is a deadly blow. He knows not that it is for his life. In other words, this is the way that leads to death. Now here again, my emphasis is this true of this sin? Well, if the husband shows up early, it sure can be, right? He may well receive a blow to death. But overall, when we think of sin in general, the wages of sin is death. It's interesting, isn't it? The gift of God's eternal life, but the wages of sin, that is, you'd worked for it. I mean, you bargained, you actually slaved away at sin for this check that is, in the final analysis, death. And so notice how this fits, not just this sin, but all sin has this nature. So what do you do? Again, now the father in these last four verses turns back to his son. He's told him the story. And in verse 24, he says, I'm trying to impress again you with the need of this wisdom. I remember E.W. Johnson saying that, he says, a father has a teenage son fixing to go out driving Saturday night. And he says, son, be careful. People get in wrecks. People get hurt. And the son says to his father, Dad, I know all about that. I've seen the pictures in driver's ed and all that. And the father says, yes, I know you know it, but I'm trying to impress it on you. There's a difference between knowing something and having it impressed on us. And what the father is doing here is once again impressing, here's why you need to listen to me. Here's why you need to learn wisdom. Verse 25, sin is so strong, so do not even, and notice the inward and the outward here. Don't let your heart go towards her ways, and don't go astray. Don't let your feet go in her paths. Here's that inward-outward thing that we saw back earlier. Don't think in these terms. Don't let your mind drift in this direction, and don't let your feet turn out of the way. Verse 26, boy, this is true, isn't it? She has cast down many wounded, many mighty, many strong men have been slain by her. Yeah. I sometimes have people say, well, you know, David committed adultery and he was forgiven, so that gives me some hope. Well, it scares me to death if a man like David, a mighty man in righteousness, can fall. What about the rest of us peons? You know, us mere mortals. What hope is there for us? So in other words, the father is trying to instruct. Notice two things that show the power of sin. How many, the number, the sheer quantity, notice many have been wounded, and then the power of it. The strong men have been overcome. I mean, we think of Samson, I guess the strongest man in the Bible, falls prey to Delilah. I mean, the guy was just a little slow when it came to women, right? And yet, she enticed him. She kept nagging him, begging him, tell me your secret, till he finally gave in. Caved in, and look what happened. Verse 27 is the way it ends, and he's impressing the end of the matter. Her house is the way to hell, going down to the chambers of death. In other words, it would help if we could see the end result. In other words, and that's what wisdom does. Wisdom doesn't look at the offer on the front end. Wisdom is able to think through the process and see the result on the back end. Wisdom can see where this thing's going to go, where this thing's going to head, where it's going to lead you. And so if you know from the front what's going to happen at the back, that ought to have a deterrent effect on you, right? There is no question that sin is pleasurable for a season. We wouldn't be tempted if it wasn't, if it didn't give us some sort of either pleasure or relief or some sort of satisfaction. We wouldn't do it. The question is the end result. Where does this thing take you? What does old Chuck French says? Sin always takes you where you don't want to go. Costs you more than you want to pay. Keeps you there longer than you want to stay. I mean, he's got a whole slew of them. Never thought I'd be quoting Chuck tonight. But anyway, but how true that is. That's the way sin works. And so what wisdom does is allow you to see from the teaching, the training, the experience of others. And I think undoubtedly this is why a lot of the stories we have in Scripture are in there. Because it teaches us, it warns us that this is where sin leads. Here's the end result. Here's the final play here. And it's not very pretty. It's the grave. It's hell. This is where this is going to take you. Okay, there we are. Any comments? Pretty strong stuff, isn't it? Charles? Yeah. She's religious. She paid her vow. She did her offered peace offering. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Under the cover of anonymity and darkness. Yep. Yep. Well, the main thing that's being emphasized here, and I think what all of us as men, is that you never take the first step. And that the first step comes from mentally flirtation. It's the mental process that begins the path that turns. And notice the emphasis here on discerning from the beginning where this is going to go so that you never take that first step. I think that's probably the most important thing, because once you start down that road, there's no stopping. I had some thoughts in looking at this tonight that, man, this is being awful rough on women. I mean, here's this poor young lad and this woman just going for him. And I got to thinking, I think about this often. I'm sure glad I'm not a woman. I mean, it's a good thing. I'm a man. I'm glad I'm not a woman. But I mean, I would hate to be in your shoes today. You're talking about the magazines in the supermarket, of the power of culture constantly stressing appearance and glamour and stuff. And honestly, we're all fighting a losing battle. I mean, beauty fades. The flower fades. It's inevitable. You can't hold on to it. And yet our culture stresses that. So number one, my heart goes out to you ladies of being in a culture that puts so much stress on appearance and these airbrushed models, you know, that's so ridiculous and so unreal, you know, unreal expectations. So my heart goes out to you. This is couched in the terms of the woman being the seducer, but when you expand this to the broader spectrum of sin in general, you can see that the woman is just as much a victim in many times as the man. It works both ways, and it's just really about the human condition. David, you were going to say something a moment ago. Oh, yeah. I had that down here, but I'm glad you're going there. Read it. You almost like James is giving you a commentary on this chapter. What he's saying, and I don't know if y'all could hear David well enough, but don't let any man say when he's tempted of God. And that goes back to that part about, well, wasn't this just destiny that we were supposed to meet like this? In other words, well, how could I help myself? God put me in this position. How could I resist? That's the idea, that I am being put in a position by God where he is forcing me to sin. And James is saying, God neither is tempted, neither does he tempt you in that sense. Now, God tempts us in the sense of puts us to the test, but if we're talking about temptation as a seduction, as an allurement to evil, God doesn't put that in us. That's what he's saying. That is not coming from God. That's coming from you. That's coming from within. And notice that what this is telling us then, since God cannot be tempted with good or evil, and you can, the very fact that you can be tempted to sin shows you've got a sin nature. You don't have to sin to know you've got a sin nature. The very idea that sin is the least bit attractive to you is the indication you've got a sin nature, because the sin is not the least bit attractive to God. You can't allure him. You can't seduce him with sin, right? Then he goes on to say that it starts with lust, and lust, when it conceives, brings forth sin, and sin, when it's finished, brings forth death. It's like a chain. That this is where it starts, the lust of the heart, and that's that sin nature, then exhibiting itself in the actual act of sin, which then is consummated, continued, and ends in the act of death. And so you've got the process. Now, I have had people ask me, say, well, you know, I have lust for this lady, and a lust is to commit adultery in your heart, so we might as well just go ahead and commit adultery. I mean, lust is adultery anyway, so why not just commit the act? Don't you know David 100 times wished that his sin had stopped with that look up on his rooftop that night? In other words, notice that this is a process that just keeps dragging you deeper and deeper and deeper. And therefore, cut it off. Nip it in the bud at the first glance. And that seems to be, Charles, you're just asking about just good practical advice. That's the thing that jumps out to me here in the father talking to his son, is don't ever turn down that way. You say, where did this guy go wrong? When he turned down that street. That's when he went wrong. Before he ever encountered her, he was already prepared to sin. Chris? It's too late, yeah. Right. That's a good illustration. Well, this is very, shall we say, down to real life. And you get the very vivid picture here of the problem and the preparation that is necessary to head sin off. Yeah, Robert?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what this is saying. Yeah, it's not to deny that there is an attract. I keep getting myself in trouble with the women for saying things like this, but there's a sense in which men recognize attractiveness. I mean, we talk about somebody being an attractive woman. What does an attractive woman do? She attracts. She wouldn't be attractive if she didn't, right? I mean, there's a sense in which we recognize beauty. And sometimes beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and if it wasn't for that, none of us would ever get married. but there is, Robert, I think that's well put. There's no use denying the fact that, yes, this is beautiful, this is attractive, but consider the end. That's what's going on here in result.